When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And this episode, I'm going to look at the absence of Russia, or the new Bolshevik state that was being created in Russia in 1919. I'm going to look at the absence of that from the Paris Peace Conference and the significance that that had. The most important missing great power in 1919 to be absent from the conference. In 1914, it had probably been the intervention of Russia in the First World War, opening up the Eastern Front, that kept the Western Allies from defeat on the Western Front. Had Germany been able to attack on one front, there is almost no doubt that the British would have been swept back into the sea and France, Paris would have fallen within a matter of weeks. So depending on which way you look at it, France, Russia's intervention was either the thing that kept the Allies from defeat or something that prolonged a wholly unnecessary war for 4 years. Russia's capacity throughout the years 1914 to 1917 to absorb terrific losses finally cracks in 1917, in February, and then by March 1918, a new Bolshevik government is agreeing terms with Germany. Between February 1917 and January 1919, Russia had transitioned between an autocracy under Tsar Nicholas II to a fledgling liberal democracy under the provisional government, to the revolutionary dictatorship of the Bolsheviks, who were obscure and unknown to most of the population, and definitely an unknown quantity to the Allied powers. During this time, of course, the Russian Empire had begun to fragment. New states such as Poland and the Baltic states emerged from the Soviet Union, the Baltic states eventually to be reclaimed. And by the time the Allies sat down to speak to one another to decide the fate of Germany, of Europe and various other matters at the Paris Peace Conference, there were already Allied armies in Russia. During 1918, as the Bolshevik government came closer and closer to an agreement with the Germans, Allied troops on Russian soil who'd been sent there in late 1917, as early as that in fact, to try to bolster support for Russia against Germany, to try to keep Russia in the war, found themselves in a position that few soldiers particularly enjoy, one where mission objectives change halfway through the mission. The task of destroying the Bolsheviks and their regime and aiding the White Armies now became a more significant role than keeping Russia in the war, though there, one objective would aid the other. Of course, the problem here was not so much the task of defeating the Red Army, but enabling the White Army to win. A mixture of old Tsarist officers, nationalist ultras, social revolutionaries, Ukrainian nationalists, the odd former provisional government liberal, all mixed together, all mutually suspicious of one another, without much of a wide base of support, with no agenda about how to redistribute land to the peasants, and thus, in doing so, get most of the peasant population on the side. Ultimately, all the White Armies can offer is more of the same, business as usual, and the same level of generally shoddy treatment to ordinary Russians that the upper classes had doled out generation on generation. This is not an attractive sell, and the fact that they were helped by foreign powers enabled the Bolsheviks to appeal to something of a nationalistic and patriotic sentiment, indicating that they were kind of an expression of popular will, which certainly they were not. By 1919, Russia is in a highly chaotic state, and it took something of an expert Russophile to be able to make much head or tail of the various competing factions and alliances. The idea that it was simply a binary civil war between old Tsarists and new Bolsheviks really ignores the complexity of the situation. There were very few people on the ground in Russia who could make sense of the situation, and even fewer in Paris, while the peacemakers gathered to decide what to do with Europe. In his Economic Consequences of the Peace, John Maynard Keynes was scathing about the inability or the refusal of European leaders to do anything to try to bring Russia in back into the international system, back into the kind of family of nations, so to speak. Instead, he said, you know, the focus of punishing Germany was a real shot in the foot for Europe, because it meant that there were so many more important matters that were not being addressed. And certainly the creation of a pariah state in Germany and a second one in the guise of the new Soviet Union did very little to stabilise Europe in the interwar years. Instead, the peacemakers in Paris were bombarded by almost endless horror stories of mutinous sailors, of murdered aristocrats, of a czar gunned down, and of peasants taking out bloody retribution on the landowners. These stories are all, by and large, true as well. Lloyd George said, "We were, in fact, never dealing with ascertained or perhaps even ascertainable facts. Russia was a jungle in which no one could say what was within a few yards of him." As we've said before, Lloyd George had an appalling grasp of geography. The parts of the Middle East that he had his eyes set on, he had very little idea roughly where they were. So his ability to know much about Russia was pretty slim. But then again, the delegation, the British Empire delegation, was there for that very reason, to present him with maps and information before he spoke. I get the sense, by reading about the peacemakers, that Russia was a problem they could be doing without, and it suited them, given their various agendas, to ignore Russia and to hope that the problem of Russia would somehow go away. Diplomats have been withdrawn from Russia in part because of the nature of the new regime, which the British, the Americans, the French and others did not wish to recognise or acknowledge as legitimate, but also because of the sheer danger of the country. Land routes were impassable, railways were cut, telegraphs took a long, long period of time to get through, if they got through at all. And the only method of, the only reliable method of getting information in and out of the country, or in and out, or back and forth to the regime anyway, was via Stockholm, where the only Bolsheviks foreign delegate and representative could be found. So there was very little contact with Russia, and there was also a big question over the legality of inviting Russia to the conference. Certainly, it was the view of Clemenceau that the Russians had betrayed the Allied cause. Clemenceau, looking at it from a French point of view, believed that the decision to leave the war had allowed Ludendorff to throw extra divisions at the Allied powers in 1918 and had given Germany, nearly given Germany, the opportunity to win the war. Lenin was seen as a treacherous figure who had allowed territory to pass to Germany in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, and this also enabled Germany to exploit the resources of Russia in order to continue fighting. And this, in the eyes of Clemenceau, meant that the Allies had no obligations to Russia, particularly obligations in the Near East. And as we know, the British and the French were looking at carving up what remained of the Ottoman Empire, and there were aspects of the Ottoman Empire that the Tsarist Russia had had their eyes on in 1914. The Dardanelles and the Bosphorus, the straits that lead between the Mediterranean and the Black Sea, for example. Russia, and on paper, it was still allied to the Western Allies. And since the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk had been renounced in 1918, when an armistice was made with the Western Allies, in theory, legally, that reignited the state of war between Germany and Russia. And the fact that there was an empty chair at the table meant that there were lots of issues that couldn't be fully resolved. Obviously, if you go to the decades before the First World War, at most of the major conferences from between 1815 and 1914, Russia had had a presence. Territorial questions that pertain to Romania, Finland, Poland, the Baltic states, to Turkey, to Persia, and to Central Asia.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
All came up and needed to have Russian input, understanding Russian intentions and what Russia's still formidable military potential was, given regarding these areas, regarding even Manchuria which was a kind of a crossroads for Japan, Russia and China, was essential. In the eyes of some of the delegates, the fear of Bolshevism defined the Paris Peace Conference. The race to rapidly create a new European order before it could be swept away by communism and by revolution. And revolutions are obviously in places such as Bavaria and Hungary throughout 1919 are breaking out. The spectre of Bolshevism meant that it was, whilst not being directly addressed at the conference, it seems to kind of colour many of the decisions made there. One only needs to look at the degree of social turmoil in Britain at the time, where you have everything from soldiers mutinying in order to demand to be sent home, to a policeman's strike, to fire brigade strikes, and the threat of industrial action, and possibly even a general strike in 1919. One of the key motivators in 1918 of offering the universal male franchise and to some extent a limited female franchise was the threat of revolution. Every time the British ruling classes have felt that revolution is close at hand, they have extended the franchise throughout the 19th century and absorbed revolutionary tensions. Now, it can be argued that in most instances, British soldiers mutinying, the threat of a workers' and soldiers' revolution in Germany, that these things were caused by local circumstances, and indeed they were. There were British soldiers demanding not to be sent to Russia or to Ireland, and German soldiers and workers protesting about the almost famine conditions in Germany. But the language of the Russian Revolution really helps to articulate these protests. There was widespread knowledge of the development of a workers' state, and despite all the atrocities and the terror and the civil war that went with this, it was widely looked upon in working class circles across Europe, America and Great Britain as being an exciting and important moment for working people everywhere. In 1918, it was the refusal of dock workers to load munitions onto the ship the Jolly George, destined for Russia, that led the wartime coalition government and the king to decline the opportunity of the Romanov family coming to seek refuge in Great Britain, and this in part sealed their fate. Russian borderlands, such as the province of Bessarabia, or the disputed territory of the Ukraine, could be easily revised by powers that claimed that they were engaging in an anti-communist crusade. Territories that had been part of the Russian Empire could now be seized. And as I mentioned in a previous podcast a few weeks ago, whilst the mapmakers at the Paris Peace Conference were drawing up new boundaries and new borders across Europe, or attempting to, the real development of new states was happening on the ground. There were nation builders using military power to seize and annex territory, and then presenting these new realities to the peacemakers at Versailles, who then had little choice but to endorse them. The spectre of communism is obviously very useful in providing justifications for this. Winston Churchill, the Secretary of State for War, said in 1919, "Of all the tyrannies in history, the Bolshevik tyranny is the worst, the most destructive, the most degrading." However, Church has a problem, and he would face this problem in the late 1930s as well, is that he was frequently derided by parliamentarians as being on the wrong side of history or given to bombast and spectacle. He had made a series of significant errors during the war, particularly the Gallipoli campaign. And the memory of Gallipoli hung over him, and he stood in rather its shadow. This, combined with the shrill language he was given to use, meant that he was very often not listened to or taken seriously. Civilization, he said in November 1918, is being completely extinguished over gigantic areas, while Bolsheviks hop and caper like troops of ferocious baboons amid the ruins of cities and the corpses of their victims. There were many Western liberals in 1919 who thought that it would take time to get a full measure of the Bolsheviks, and that in the meantime they may well prove to be useful and reliable, and then society might emerge in Russia along the lines which Western liberals rather thought would be good. This view, by the way, persists and persists. You even have in the 1930s Roosevelt having similar views, that once the kind of the mayhem of Stalinism settled down, that a mature society, perhaps even a democratic society, might emerge, or at least a quasi-democratic republic might emerge. After all, there was all sorts of embarrassment and deep unease amongst the British and French in 1914, being allied with the autocratic absolutist monarchy of Tsarist Russia. Lloyd George was ecstatic when the February Revolution happened and the Tsar was overthrown, and the view that the British Liberal and Conservative parties had in general was that they were the victims of their own folly. They 1918 is the only time, really, that Britain, America and France begin to talk in a united way in the language of democracy and rights. Before that, there's no such rhetoric, and it's only because of the introduction of America, a liberal democracy, into the war, and the transition of Russia from an autocracy to, hopefully, a fledgling liberal democracy, that makes any of this position have any coherence or make any sense at all. And there was something to be said for the fact that both modern France and the United States were the product of revolutions. Wilson, showing spectacular naivety, initially thought that the Bolsheviks were something akin to America's progressives, that they were about curbing business strength, business power in politics, and about limiting the role of big government in people's lives and giving the individual a greater autonomy and freedom. The violence of it, the confiscation of property, the mass killing, Wilson thought should be condemned. But he said that, you know, there were aspects of their doctrine that had been really the result of kind of rapacious capitalism anyway, were it not for Russia's industrialist robber barons and the predations of the upper classes. Well, there'd be no need for all this unpleasantness. This is what happens when the rights of workers are disregarded. But rather like Roosevelt, a generation after him, it looks like Wilson thought that this would all settle down in the long run. Both were more concerned about unrest in Western societies, both Wilson and Lloyd George, that is, and both believed that if the root causes of the attraction of Bolshevism were addressed, then there would be a little chance of Bolshevism penetrating Western Europe or America. And it's something of this thought, really, continues throughout the remainder of the 20th century. there is much evidence to suggest that the motivation for the development of Western welfare states, of mixed economies, later on commitments to full employment and social reform in general, was born of an understanding that there were other options that populations could take if they weren't satisfied with the one on offer. As Wilson put it when he was discussing the inequalities in America, seeds need soil, and the Bolshevik seeds found the soil already prepared for them. Lloyd George said that he would like to have seen the Russians at the conference. He believed that Russian soldiers had fought very bravely in the war and they had been very badly let down by their leadership. But also, he knew that countries with claims on Russian territory were there. Lloyd George wasn't simply being sentimental. He knew that in order to prevent wars in the future, or to make them less likely, that arbitrage needed to happen. Countries with claims on Russian territory would have to fight for that territory once again very soon when Russia got back on its feet, because Russia would see the decision to cede territory to its neighbours as illegitimate, as surely it would be, and it would seek to return these territories using military force. So in the interests of long-term stability, Russia needed to be at the table. Now, in a later podcast this week, I'm going to start looking at the methods in which the Allied powers engaged to try to get Russia unsuccessfully to the table. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this. Thanks very much. And if you can give us a good review on iTunes, that would be greatly appreciated. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.